This is a Dharma talk recorded at the Boulder Inside Meditation Group.
In other Buddhist traditions, you'll hear these called the four gems, the four immeasurables. We're talking about four wholesome mind states: loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity. And in the Theravada tradition, which I practice and teach in, loving kindness is the one that is most emphasized, unlike in the Mahayana traditions and the Vajrayana traditions that you often encounter here in Boulder, where compassion is the big number, numero uno. If you ever heard the Dalai Lama speak, if he didn't say compassion at least 57 times in any talk he gave, it wouldn't be a Dalai Lama speech, right? It's because he's from that Tibetan tradition that has that as the key. The thinking behind loving kindness being the core is that once you've developed a heart full of loving kindness and you turn that heart towards someone who's suffering, compassion naturally will arise. If you turn that heart towards someone who's happy, sympathetic joy, a joy in the seeing others happy, naturally arises. And equanimity is the thing that ties everything together and balances everything out. So we don't go to any extremes in either direction with any of these four noble mind states. So that's the context of the Buddha's teaching. The Buddha spoke about these four. I read at the end of the sit is, you know, one of many places in the sutta where the Buddha speaks about these. But the Metta Sutta itself is the only one I know of that is exclusively speaking directly to just metta, and was the original teaching he gave about this important topic. And traditionally, if someone was taught anything like this, anything from any of the suttas or the Pali Canon, especially before there was writing, I mean, the Buddhist teachings weren't even written down to about 300 years after his death, so it was all an oral tradition. And even in many places for years after that, no one had anything to write on, let alone, you know, especially the poor, the people who were poor. So this is, for a long time, being an oral tradition. And the way you learned things was you first had to learn to chant the entire sutta. And then when you could chant it perfectly, then the teacher would start explaining it to you. But not until then. Well, I'm not going to insist that you chant it perfectly, but I thought I'd chant it for you, just so you can get a sense for what it's like. And I want to just mention something in the notation in this thing I handed out, because it'll help you understand. The way the suttas are chanted is very similar to something called Vedic chanting. So if any of you have any familiarity with Vedic chanting in the Hindu traditions, it's the same idea. Basically, you find a tone, and then if you look at the text, you'll see little arrows pointing down and little arrows pointing up. Little arrow down means go down half a tone on that syllable, and a little arrow going up means go up half a tone. That's it. It's not particularly musical. And oh yeah, when you see something underlined, two beats instead of one. So you hold that note a little longer. That's the entire method. And it goes something like this. Please excuse me if I don't perfectly get the tones correct. I'm still practicing. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties, and frugal in their way, peaceful and calm, and wise and skillful, not proud and demanding in nature, Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another, or despise any being in any state. Let none, through anger or ill will, wish harm upon another, even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child. So with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings, radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will, whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. So first of all, I want to recommend the chanting of sutta is a great practice. You get a feeling for this when you hear it chanted, which is very different from reading it as text. And if you chant it yourself over and over and over again, it grows on you, both as a heart-opening exercise and also just it's very sweet to chant the sutta. This one in particular, there are others like this one. This is one of my faves, what can I say? So what I wanted to do, however, is now that we've got a sense for what it's like, is to actually work through this and look at what this actually means. What is the Buddha actually talking about here? And so I'm sort of, not quite line by line, but almost line by line, I want to go through this and talk a little bit about what's being said here. So the first thing I want to talk about, this is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. The key word here is skilled. The Buddha isn't saying this is what should be done by someone who's good. This is someone who is skilled in goodness. Someone who practices goodness. And this is, there's a difference. It's very easy to think of ourselves as good people. It's not so easy to consciously, mindfully practice goodness. It's a different idea. It implies a great deal more energy and commitment. I want to read you a little something from... Oops, there's all my notes. I want to read you something from Joseph Goldstein, which I think puts this into context. This is from his book called Mindfulness, which is his new book that came out about last October. And I read this these two paragraphs when I was first reading through the book. I'm on my third time through the book right now, actually. And this just struck me as so pithy. So much of what the Buddha taught seems so obvious. Don't kill, don't steal, don't harm. Still, as we try to apply and practice this in our lives, we've come to the forward edge of our understanding about commitment. And this edge can be a challenging place to be. One teacher commented that if practicing the precepts, the virtues, doesn't make us uncomfortable. I'll read that line again. One teacher commented that if practicing the precepts doesn't make us uncomfortable, it's probably a sign that we should investigate them more deeply. I appreciate this comment because it points to these steps on the path as actual practices, things to understand and investigate in our lives, rather than taking it for granted that we're basically good people and then looking no further. It's just, it's so easy to be complacent. And the Buddha is saying, no, no. Right at the very beginning of the sutta, he says, no, this is someone who is skilled in goodness, someone who is consciously practicing goodness. The Buddha never messed around. The next line, straightforward and gentle in speech. Well, here we are, all of us, right away, this is one of the five precepts, you know, the five virtues. And he's talking about straightforward and gentle in speech, telling the truth and not speaking harshly. These are things we have to practice. It isn't something we just naturally do. Humble and not conceited. Humble also refers to speech, to not boasting or stretching the truth a little bit. And we do that. You know, we sort of make things sound a little better than they are, especially if it's about us, because it builds us up, makes us look important and good and wonderful. It's so common for us to do that, and we have to watch that one. Not conceited expresses the idea that we shouldn't think we're better than others, since this separates us from them. As soon as we think, I'm better than them, or I'm worse than them, which is another form of conceit, then we're separating ourselves from those people. There's them and us. I'm above them, I'm below them. And as soon as we do that, we're separated from them. It's very hard to have a feeling of loving kindness for someone that you don't feel connected with. It's just not as easy or not possible even to not feel. For metta to blossom, there has to be that sense of connection, of oneness. Contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties, and frugal in their ways. This is another of the precepts expressed in a different way. This is a taking only what is offered, which means more than just not stealing. Right? To live simply, to use only what you need, to not accumulate excess. Boy, there's a good description of what our culture tells us to do, right? To just get as much stuff as you can and pack it away. I'm working for a guy right now, in my work, and there he and his wife are moving, and he's a hoarder, and the whole bottom of their house, the whole bottom floor of their house is floor-to-ceiling boxes of stuff. It's like unbelievable how much stuff is in this house, and it's just that desire to have more than you need. That's another meaning of taking only what is offered. If you have more than you need, then someone probably has less. Peaceful and calm. This isn't directly speak to the precepts, one of the five precepts, but it describes a state of mind, in a sense. We wish to start when we practice. We want to start from a place where we're peaceful and calm if we're going to practice metta, if we're going to practice loving kindness. It's pretty hard to practice loving kindness when you're all uptight about something, all wound up. Joseph tells this great story about one time he was on retreat, and he was actually doing a metta retreat. And he'd go for a walk every day, and one day this big dog came out, bark, 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 bark. And he's going, oh, I should offer metta to the dog, right? So he's saying, may you be safe, may you be happy. And the dog came up and bit him. And he realized that even though in his mind he is repeating the metta phrases, in his heart he was like, the mind state wasn't there, just the words. And that's, the dog picked up on that. Chomp. And that's, it's so true. If we're going to, we have to watch our mind state all the time if we're going to be full of loving kindness all the time. Otherwise, we're going to be playing at being loving and kind as opposed to actually doing it. So we need to have this peaceful and calm mind. Then the Buddha says, let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. This is a classic Buddhist trick. I've made a big long list of all these things, and then I put a sentence at the end that says, and if I haven't said it specifically, it's still covered. You know, it's like anything else you could think of that the wise would reprove, shouldn't do that either. You don't want to have that as part of your mind state when you're practicing metta. So you could include all the other precepts, anything else you might want to throw in there. You know, it's like the catch-all. Just to make sure we've covered everything, there's this one too. You see this all through the sutta. The Buddha does this over and over and over again. He'll make this big long list and then he'll, and also anything else. Pretty cool trick. So that's that first section that I just described is sort of a description of where do we want to be when we start? And it isn't something, you know, don't get discouraged. I mean, this is essentially something we aspire to. This isn't necessarily, well, I'm not all these things. I'm not perfect, which is basically what we're describing here. So I can't practice metta. I'm not good enough. Don't fall into that trap. This is something to aspire to, and also in the actual practice of metta, these mind states, these attributes that the Buddha is talking about in the sutta arise and are strengthened as you practice. So it's, they feed each other in a sense. But there are more things to keep in mind if as you take up the practice. Then you get to the second section, which starts to describe the actual practice itself, how to do this. Wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. This is a summation of the four classic phrases that are used when you practice metta as a meditation practice. You know, may you be safe, may you be happy, may you be healthy, may you live with ease. The idea behind metta as a formal practice, but also just as an idea that you might want to keep in mind, reacting with other beings of all sorts, is that what we're wishing for is that both ourselves, because you do metta for yourself as well, and other beings, all other beings, have perfect conditions for practice. That's really what we're saying here. You know, if I'm safe, I don't have to be worried about someone dropping a bomb on me or mugging me in the street or whatever. You know, there's a lot of people who aren't safe in this world right now. All you have to do is read the newspaper. May you be happy. Wow, that's great. I had a teacher, by the way, who said that was asking for too much. She said, may you be content was all she could live with. And that's okay. So these are phrases are malleable to a certain extent. May you be healthy and may you live with ease. These are like, like the phrase, may all beings be at ease. If you have health, or as much health as possible, given your age or your condition. And may you live with ease is, may you not have to struggle to get the basics of life. You know, may you have enough food on the table or a roof over your head. And if you have those conditions, if you're safe, you're content, you're happy, you have health as best as you can expect, and you have a situation where you're living, your day-to-day stuff is taken care of somehow or other, maybe because you have a job or maybe, who knows, then you have the conditions where there's no worries, nothing distracting you, nothing stirring up your mind all the time. Now I can just practice. Isn't this great? It's like literally it's the conditions for practice. And that's what we wish for others and for ourselves. That's what metta is talking about. Continuing on. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none. This is another difficult aspect of this practice. Whatever living beings there may be, you can't exclude anyone. In fact, it then repeats it, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none. And you'll notice through the sutta, this gets repeated 3 or 4 more times. You can't leave people out. You can't have loving kindness for some people, the good guys, and, well, I don't want to wish that guy loving kindness, he's a jerk. Or those people. Or those executives at Monsanto. Oof, don't want to wish them loving kindness, you know. Or whatever. You know, we all have our little biases, right? You know, we don't want to do those people, they're the bad people. Can't do that. If you have loving kindness for all beings, it means literally that. It also, by the way, means not only human beings, but of course, dogs and cats. Well, those are pretty easy. In Boulder, everybody has a dog, right? But what about reptiles and spiders and sharks? Whatever, you know, just everybody has their things that, you know, the creepy ones, you know. And got to have loving kindness. They're all beings. Got to have loving kindness for all of them, too. Can't exclude any beings. Tall order. And then he sort of makes sure we understand what that means in the next line. The seen and the unseen. This refers to sort of the Buddhist cosmology where there are beings other than human beings that we are interacting with in various ways who live in other realms. Angelic realm, you know, and not so angelic realms, you know, the realm of the hungry ghosts and these other places. You don't have to believe this stuff. It's a cosmology that the Buddha was deeply embedded in culturally and spoke of regularly. But it is an interesting way to think of that there are, even if you just think of just human beings, there are some human beings that are just angelic. And there are other human beings that are demonic in their appearance as we interact. And you can think of it just that way if you don't want to go into the cosmology of, you know, heaven realms and hell realms and all those sorts of other realms. It's okay. Don't get caught on this one. But that's what the Buddha meant. He meant those other realms. Those living near and far away. This is an interesting way to think about it. It's really easy to have loving kindness with people close to us. Our family, our friends, the people we work with, the people here in the Sangha. Well, it's pretty easy to have loving kindness for all those people. They're all near. But think of how many people there are far away compared to how many people are near to you. I mean, maybe you might know the names of a couple hundred people. If you're really good at remembering names, I'm terrible. And then beyond that, it's like, then there's all those other people, just in Boulder, let alone far away. Those people in Peru. Who knows we don't even know who they are. We don't know, it's like hard to conceive even. And there's 7 billion if we're just talking about people, there's 7 billion people on the earth right now. That's a lot. Once again, so all beings means all beings. Those living near, close to us, that's easy. Far away, not so easy, because we don't have, it's hard to grok, hard to take in even that there are 7 billion people. And what does that mean? Those born and to be born. It's tricky, because in our culture, the word the unborn has a certain political connotation to it, almost. I don't know, maybe political isn't the right word. But I don't think that's what the Buddha was talking about here. I think the Buddha was talking about future generations. That when we have thoughts of loving kindness, we have to think about those that come after us. This is a very sort of ecological statement, in a sense. It's like we have to think of future generations as well as our own, which starts to be, boy, that's a lot of people. if I just have to deal with the 7 billion that are here now, that would be hard. But how about all those ones that haven't even been born yet? Future generations. But that implies a certain sense of loving kindness towards other beings. Being careful about how you treat the earth, literally. And I think that's what the Buddha meant here. So that's, and there, so it's an interesting list, because he looks at these things. He says, let's divide things up in different ways. You know, those born and not yet born, those living near and far away, the seen and the unseen. This is another classic Buddhist trick of like, let's break things into classification. So instead of saying all, okay, there's the seen and the unseen, the born and to be born, those living near and far away. So you break it into pieces, so it's a little easier take in and understand than just all. When you do actually metta practice for all beings, the formal practice, there's 7 different categories of all beings. They break it into these 7 different groups, so you can sort of get a handle on it a bit easier when you do the practice. Then we move on to the next section. Oops, turn the page. And this is an interesting little section. It's just 4 lines. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. This is what is called traditionally the far enemy of loving kindness. It's ill will. Loving kindness is sometimes translated as good will. This is the description of ill will. This is where our mind goes about certain people. People we don't get along with. Or certain classes of people. Or certain races of people. Or certain football teams. Nothing worse than those 49ers, you know. Well, whatever, you know, we all have these little things where we just like, we exclude them. And then there's ill will towards them, as opposed to goodwill. And it's real easy to fall into this. Consider this, as well. My teacher said this to me once, and it really, really struck me as, wow, I never thought of it quite that way. Think of all the times you might think about someone. You know, you're reading something in the news, or you're watching something on TV, or there's someone you hear something, and you think, that person got what they deserved. That is ill will. Just that thought is ill will. You're happy they're suffering. This almost sounds like human nature, doesn't it? But that's ill will. It's someplace we all go to. All the time. Yeah. So it's something we have to watch in ourselves. This is a place where it's very easy to go from goodwill to ill will. Just like that. So mindfulness, here we go. Mindfulness is a very strong part of metta practice. Because we have to see these things as they arise in our minds and go, oh, look at that. Ill will right there. And shift it in the mind. Then, the next section. How strong should the feeling of metta be? This is my two of the most beautiful lines in the whole sutta. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child. That's how strong this feeling needs to be. Think about what that means. How much energy a mother would put into protecting the life of her only child. Could be a father, by the way. It's very traditional teaching. It's like, wow, that's really intense. That's a lot. That isn't just like, well, if I got time, I'll do something about it. Or, well, maybe once a week for half an hour. It's like, yeah, this is like a full-time job. You know, even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child. I can't imagine anything that would express it more strongly than that. So with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. And then a bit later on he talks about outwards and unbounded. Ill will, the opposite, binds us. If we have ill will towards someone, we're bound to them. We're tied to them. Desmond Tutu says we're chained to them when he talks about this. It's because we're caught in that perpetual storytelling we have in the mind about that person and how they done me wrong. Or what a jerk they are, or. We all have these stories we tell ourselves about certain people in our lives. In formal meta practice, these are, by the way, called the difficult people. We all have difficult people, right? People that we struggle to get along with. Everybody's smiling, going, oh yeah, yeah. And some of us, luckily, maybe only have one or two, and some people just seem to have, this is your life. It's a lot of difficult people. Yeah. And it's the problem is when we're thinking about those people, and usually we're thinking in a very habitual, repetitive way. We tell these same old stories about, how my mother never loved me, or how my weird Uncle Harry was such a jerk, or that guy at work, he just doesn't get it, or whatever it is, those people. And we just tell these stories over and over again. And as we're telling these stories to ourselves, what's happening at the same time is all of the unwholesome mind states that go along with those stories, anger, ill will, sadness, fear. That's what we're experiencing. And we're creating our own suffering over and over and over again by simply retelling those stories yet again. We're caught, we're bound to those people. Often, these people aren't in our lives anymore even. This could be something that happened 20 years ago. I'll tell you, this is a little story, personal story. When I sit, this didn't happen in my last long sit, but for 7 or 8, really, I sit for about a month every year, for 7 or 8 years in a row. Somewhere in the middle of my long sitting period, this story about how these guys at Microsoft screwed me 20 years ago when they were going to do this and then they didn't do it. And I go through this whole drama about this story. And it's like, oh God, not this one again. It's like, I thought I'd work this one out, But it's like all the anger and feeling of disappointment and it's all there. 20 years later, there it is. Oh, this one again. Maybe it's gone away. Who knows? It's just, and we just do this to ourselves. And the antidote, the antidote to those moments when we actually are mindfully aware that we're caught in one of these stories, because it's always about someone, is to shift that to metta for that person. instead of being caught in anger and ill will towards that person, offer them metta. May you be safe, may you be happy, may you be healthy, may you live with ease. Hold them in your mind, see an image of them, and repeat those phrases. Literally, that's what your practice becomes at that moment. Even if you're supposedly doing Vipassana. I'm a serious Vipassana person. I just let whatever happens, happen. Sorry, time to switch. Time for a little antidote here. It's called skillful means. And it's a way to shift those stories, to smooth them, to soften them. And eventually they just go away. Here we are. Here's another classic one. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. Well, basically, when you think about it, if you're not standing, walking, seated, or lying down, what are you doing? This is basically another classic Buddha trick. All the time is what this means. Okay? He uses this cute little list, you know. But basically, it also means you can practice this anytime. You can be walking down the street. Joseph Goldstein recommends this. He said, you're just walking down the street, you're going to the grocery store or the pharmacy or going to work. Every being that you see, maybe say, next being, just everyone that catches your attention, just offer them metta. Make that a practice. So now I don't have to be sitting on a cushion. I don't have to be in any formal situation. I can just be going to work, practicing metta. It just shifts things when you start seeing beings, all beings that you encounter in your daily experience, and offer them metta. Then you're really practicing sitting, standing, walking, lying down. Oh, in fact, in the Satipatthana Sutta, the Buddha says, after that he says, or any other position you might find yourself in. Just once again, just in case we missed anything, you know. Today would have to be standing, walking, seated, lying down, or driving a car. You know, we'd have to put that one in there, but, you know. Okay. So it's not only everyone. Not only is it all beings. It's all beings all the time. When you practice this formally, the teacher encourages you to literally never stop repeating the phrases. Literally, you wake up, you start repeating the phrases, you go to sleep. The last thing you do as you go to sleep is you're repeating the phrases. A whole day. 18 hours a day, typically. It's interesting to try and do that. Just even if you try for an hour, it's interesting. But all day for a month is even more interesting. But it's just practice. So now we get to the last section, which I've labeled here, the results, and I hated that word, but I couldn't think of a better word. What happens if you actually practice metta? This is something that you practice. This is said to be the sublime abiding. Metta practice just makes you feel happy. I can't say it more plainly than that. Both in a formal way when I have those moments during my day where I go, I catch myself sliding towards, ill will towards someone I encounter in my daily life, and I just shift it. It just lightens your heart. Just like, that feels much better than, it just feels better. The only way I can describe it. It's sublime. It really, it truly is. When we fill the mind with wholesome thoughts of loving kindness, there's no room for unwholesome thoughts to arise. It's as simple as that. If you consciously practice having the mind be in a wholesome mind state, the more often it's in a wholesome mind state, the less often it'll be in an unwholesome one. Because the mind can only be in one mind state at a time. Now, don't get all upset when it goes away, because they will. All of these mind states, even wholesome mind states like mindfulness and metta, are impermanent. Back to impermanence. There we are, back to the basic world of Buddhist teaching. But everything is impermanent, even wholesome mind states. So don't get caught in blaming yourself. Oh, I was so sweet, and I was just in this wonderful metta state, and then there I am, and I'm growling at this person. Just know that that's what happens. We're there, that mind state's there, and then the mind shifts. And there we are in an unwholesome mind state. And then you notice that, and you go, oh, maybe I can shift that consciously. That's called right effort. Sixth step on the Eightfold Path. Then it goes on, by not holding to fixed views, much of the ill will we feel towards others is because we are caught by our views about things. These people are good, these people are bad. This is right, this is wrong. Those are views. And much of the ill will we feel towards others is because we think we're right and they're wrong. We're good and they're bad. That's where ill will arises, by having fixed views and being so sure that this is the right way, that anyone who doesn't believe that is wrong. The fools. What's wrong with them? You know, blah, 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 blah. And there we are, off on an ill will rant about Muslim fundamentalists or whatever. It's a popular one these days for people to rant about, right? So, but they're just people, just like us. They suffer. They live their lives. We have to include them too. All beings, without exception. And it's views. And views could be cultural. It could be based on our sexual orientation. It could be based on our political beliefs. It could be based on our favorite football team. Like I said, it could be anything. Those views are what create our ill will and then create suffering because of that ill will. Now, there's one teacher who says, if you could just get rid of views, you'd be enlightened. It's like, just get rid of all your views and you'll be enlightened. It's real simple. But that's an interesting perspective. Right? Just get rid of being attached to view. And everything might change. It's interesting to watch and see those times when you are in states of ill will, to look a little deeper and see, what view am I holding right now about this situation or this person or this group of people or whatever that's creating this ill will? See if you can see the view that underlies, that got you there. Because there'll be one. Pretty much guaranteed there'll be one. Or several sometimes. They interact and amplify each other. The pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires. So here we arrive right back at the core of the Buddhist teachings. One who truly practices metta for all beings is pure-hearted. Clarity of vision is another way of saying having right understanding. Here we are back at the first step on the Eightfold Path yet again. The teachings of the Buddha are very cyclical. And we just keep coming back. We have a little better understanding, and we practice some more, and we sort of go along, and we get deeper into concentration, and we get a little more mindful, and then that gives us a deeper understanding of some things we didn't see quite clearly before. So the Buddha here is talking directly about having right understanding. Freed from all sense desires. Here we are. second noble truth and the third noble truth. There we go. So it's like all the beauty of the Metta Sutta, I think, is all of the Buddha's teachings are in this one sutta, just in a different form. But you can see all of the Buddha's teachings right here in this one sutta, just expressed in a different way, from a different point of view, from a different angle. And then when one really is freed from all sense desires, when one reaches that state, then is not born again into this world. It's the last line in the sutta. This is the classic way of saying that someone's enlightened. They are not born again into this world. People, you know, according to the traditional Buddhist teaching, we go through lifetime after lifetime after lifetime after lifetime. I'm enlightened. Finally, after thousands of lifetimes, who knows? At that point, an enlightened being literally, I mean, they call them enlightened because they're like beacons of light in the world. They radiate the teaching out into the world. I mean, think about it. The Buddha lived 2,600 years ago. And here I am teaching his teachings 2,600 years later. And I'm one of like how many thousands of people are doing that tonight, let alone people who are sitting, listening, or studying, or reading books. It's enormous. Just that one person, one time, enlightenment spreads all over the place. And metta leads directly to enlightenment. That's the last line. That's where we're headed. This practice, in and of itself, just loving kindness all by itself, leads you to enlightenment. This also, and I have to say this, because I was thinking about this phrase on my last sit, actually. Is not born again into this world has or had for me, there was this discomfort about it. And the discomfort arose around how I'd often heard that phrase used in teachings both in this tradition and in Hindu yoga traditions I've been part of for many, many years, where it's like, whew, I finally don't have to have a body anymore. It has that sort of body-hating connotation to it that is perpetuated to a certain extent by renunciates, by monks and nuns in particular, who feel that way because they have given up any bodily pleasure. And there's a great danger in this, I think, because it can very easily turn into body hating. I don't want to have a body. Having a body's no good. When I finally get it together, I won't have to have a body anymore. Is how that statement is often interpreted. But this is an incorrect understanding of what is actually being said here. Basically, what's being said is, my teacher Guy Armstrong talks all the time about bundles of karmic energy. So when this body falls away, I, me, Barry, this person, this personality, that's not what gets reborn. That's not what takes another body. There is what Guy calls a bundle of karmic energy, which is the results of the practice or lack of practice that this being and countless other beings who all had personal identities added to that bundle. But the bundle has no personality in and of itself at all. And at some point, that bundle of karmic tendencies grows closer and closer to enlightenment. And then at some point, the body associated with that bundle is enlightened. At that point, that bundle of karmic energy has done its job. It's created an enlightened being. It's just another impermanent thing. Even that thing that goes from one, takes on one body and another body and another body and another body, is just another impermanent thing. And once someone is in that, that bundle of karmic energy is associated with an enlightened being, it's no longer necessary. It's gone. It's impermanent. Just like everything else. And that's what being not born again into this world is all about. It's that, it's just another statement that even that is impermanent, which is one of the three central teachings that the Buddha talked about over and over and over and over and over and over again. Impermanence. We have to see impermanence in everything. If we think that somehow, well, everything's impermanent but that, which it's pretty easy to fall into. Well, it's the soul or something that's going to last forever. Sorry, it doesn't work that way. It's just yet another impermanent thing. And so, is not born again into this world, is this stating the obvious? This person has become enlightened, therefore that bundle of karmic energy is gone. It's just another impermanent phenomenon that arose somehow. It was there for billions of years, who knows how long, and then it's gone. Just took a while longer. It was a bit more permanent than a lot of other things, but it's just gone, like everything else. So it's actually just an interesting way to say it's over, folks. It's like everything else. It was just there, and now it's gone. So I have 3 minutes left. Oh my God! I was going to have you all chant the Metta Sutta with me to finish. Can we go 2 extra minutes? Okay, because I just think that would be a great way to finish. And don't think you have to know how to sing. I'm king of the frogs. I can do this. Anyone can. This is all about how it feels coming from your heart. That's all that's important. If you don't have your reading glasses, feel free to hum along, and that'll be fine too. It's more, like I say, from the heart than the actual anything else. So we just do this in unison. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties, frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm, wise and skillful, not proud and demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove, wishing in gladness and in safety. May all beings be at ease, whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none, through anger or ill will, wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings, radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will, whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding, by not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. May the beneficial energies arising from our practice here together today become the causes and conditions for the end of suffering and the awakening of all beings everywhere. Thank you all for coming and sharing this time with me.
This has been a Dharma Talk at Boulder Insight Meditation. Find out more at insightcolorado.org.